How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? Yes, and how many seas must a white dove sail before...
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is October 28, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is
The Answer, My Friend, Is Blowing in Your Nose,
High Flow Nasal Oxygen. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Justin Morgenstern. Justin is an emergency physician and the director of simulation education at Markham Stouffville Hospital in Ontario. He loves skepticism. Ooh, I like him already. Medical education. Oh, you are going up in the polls there, Justin. And you really like it when it's free and open access. Well, that's the trifecta. He's the author of a FOMED blog called First10EM.com and is an associate editor of Emergency Medicine Cases. Welcome to the SGEM, Justin.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be part of such an amazing podcast.
Well, tell the SGEMers about your blog, this First10EM.com. Give us your elevator pitch.
Yeah, so I think we all love emergency medicine because we're tasked with looking after every specialty's sickest patients. But that's also the hard part. We have to be ready to deal with every specialty's sickest patients in situations when we just don't have time to look things up. We need to have a plan. So I started First 10EM as a project to review those first 10 minutes. And I'm sorry, Ken, I know it should have been five, but those first 10 minutes in the resuscitation room in some of the most critical scenarios we'll face so that I, and hopefully my readers, can spend some time to mentally prepare, to really rehearse the necessary steps in my mind, in our minds, so that we can be ready whenever a critically ill patient is delivered to our doorstep.
Well, you did a fantastic post recently on the new AHA guidelines.
Thank you so much.
Now, it's great to have a fellow skeptic on the program, but I wish you could have been here in Boston at ASEP 2015 to record the show in person.
Oh, I really wish I was there with you.
But why don't you start this episode of the SGEM with a case scenario?
Absolutely. A 60-year-old male with no major past medical history presents to your community emergency department with a three-day history of cough, fever, and increasing shortness of breath. He is tachypneic with a respiratory rate of 28 and an oxygen saturation of 89% despite face max oxygen, but he's mentating normally. Your respiratory therapist asks you, do you want me to try this new high-flow nasal oxygen machine?
Yeah, what exactly is high-flow nasal oxygen? Isn't it just the use of normal nasal prongs turned up really, really high?
No, Ken. High-flow nasal oxygen is a novel device that actively humidifies and heats air to make flows of up to 60 liters a minute tolerable. These incredibly high flows are important because in order to provide 100% FiO2 to patients in respiratory distress, we must be able to match their minute ventilation.
And high-flow nasal oxygen offers a theoretical benefit of low levels of PEEP and allows for much easier communication with our patients.
Yeah, it's gained popularity in pediatrics for the treatment of severe bronchiolitis, and it is seeing a wider adoption among adult patients. In addition to allowing our patients to speak more easily, the few patients I've tried it on have really appreciated being able to eat and drink.
So what's the clinical question we're going to try to answer on today's podcast?
So in adult ICU patients with hypoxic respiratory distress not due to chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, asthma, or congestive heart failure, and who do not require immediate intubation, does high-flow nasal oxygen or non-invasive ventilation therapy compared to standard therapy alone reduce the rate of endotracheal intubation and improve outcomes?
And what's the reference that you have to answer this question?
So we're going to look at Fratt et al., high-flow oxygen through nasal cannula in acute hypoxemic respiratory failure from the New England Journal of Medicine in 2015.
Well, if you'd listened to the show, Justin, you know we run through the PICO. So what's the population in Fratt's study?
So these were adult ICU patients with acute hypoxic respiratory failure.
And for the inclusion criteria, they had to have all four. So they had to have four out of four of these criteria. And one was a respiratory rate of greater than 25 per minute. And I don't know if that's 25 per minute. And a PO2 over FiO2 ratio of less than 300. Justin, 300. Great movie. And a PCO2 of less than 45. And no clinically underlying chronic respiratory failure. There were a bunch of exclusion criteria. I won't go through them. I'll list them on the blog. But what was the intervention?
So they looked at either high-flow nasal oxygen or non-invasive positive pressure ventilation.
And what did they compare it to?
So they compared it to standard face max oxygen.
And their primary outcome?
The rate of intubation at 28 days.
And their secondary outcome was mortality in the ICU, mortality at 90 days, the number of vent-free days, between 1 and 28 days, and the duration of ICU stay. And I want to point out something subtle here, but they don't mention morbidity at 28 days, because when you pull up the original protocol, it says the secondary outcome, mechanical ventilation free to day 28, and ICU morbidity at 28 days. They don't specifically mention ICU mortality or ICU mortality at 90 days. But here are the author's conclusions. Quote, in patients with non-hypercapnic acute hypoxemic respiratory failure, treatment with high-flow oxygen, standard oxygen, or non-invasive ventilation did not result in significantly different intubation rates. There was a significant difference in favor of high-flow oxygen in 90-day mortality. End of quote. So here are the 11 checklist questions for RCTs, or randomized clinical control trials. Question number one, Justin, the study population, are they ED patients?
So no, these were adult patients from 23 ICUs in France and Belgium.
And did they randomize them adequately?
Yeah, they used permuted blocks of six in a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio.
And did they conceal that randomization?
Yep.
And did they do an intention to treat analysis?
Yes, they performed an intention to treat analysis.
And did they have consecutive patients, i.e. no selection bias?
Yes.
And how about question six? The patients in both groups, were they similar with respect to their prognostic factors?
Yes.
And all participants, were they unaware of which group they were assigned?
So no, Ken. Clinicians and patients were aware of their group assignment. We are not sure if the assessors were blinded.
All right. Question eight. All groups, were they treated equally except for that intervention?
No. For the standard and nasal oxygen group, a trial of non-invasive ventilation was allowed before intubation, but the number of patients who got this therapy is not presented. Also, this is an open-label study, so other unreported treatment differences may have occurred.
All right. Was follow-up complete?
Yeah, they had 100% 90-day follow-up.
All right. And were all patient-important outcomes considered?
Yes.
And the final question, the treatment effect. Do you think it was large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
No.
All right, so let's go through the key results. They had a total of 310 patients that were included in the analysis and about 100 in each of the groups. The primary outcome was intubation rate at 28 days, and this showed no statistical difference. Can you give us the actual numbers?
So for the standard group, the intubation rate was 48%. In the high-flow nasal oxygen group, it was 38%. And the non-invasive ventilation group, it was 50%.
And so the intubation rate at 28 days was roughly somewhere between 40 and 50%, and there wasn't a statistical difference between the three treatment groups. How about the secondary outcome, that 90-day ICU mortality? It showed a statistical difference, didn't it?
Yeah, so in the standard group, they had a 23% 90-day mortality, whereas the high-flow nasal oxygen group had a 12% mortality. The non-invasive ventilation group had a 28% mortality.
And we'll put up some more details on the numbers in the blog, but it's time to talk a little nerdy here.
So this was a multi-center trial attempting to ask an important question in critical care medicine. However, there were a number of limitations to this study that threatened the validity of the conclusions. We came up with, you guessed it, five concerns.
Aw, thanks for picking my favorite number. All right, so the first concern we had was about the exclusion and inclusion criteria. We see a lot of patients that require respiratory support, and they had to close to 5,000 patients in this cohort with acute respiratory failure. But over 2,000 patients were excluded, with almost 1,400 for chronic lung disease and close to 700 because of cardiogenic pulmonary edema. And we know from many other studies that patients with COPD and cardiogenic pulmonary edema have a mortality benefit from non-invasive ventilation.
Of the 525 eligible for inclusion, 160 were excluded for logistic reasons. It's not clear what that means, but it could have introduced some selection bias and negated the recruitment of consecutive patients.
And the vast majority of these patients, greater than 80%, had a diagnosis of pneumonia. So this makes it difficult to extrapolate this data set to all patients who enter the emergency department with acute hypoxic respiratory distress.
So our second concern was this study was not blinded. This could have introduced some bias into the results by influencing the treating staff not to intubate the intervention group as compared to the control.
However, they did have pre-specified criteria for endotracheal intubation, some of which were objective, while other criteria was more subjective, like copious tracheal secretions. I'm not exactly sure what copious means to you. I know what copious secretions mean to me, but you and I might have a difference what we refer to as copious. So there was a subjective nature to some of this.
Absolutely.
The third thing was contamination. There was a fair amount of contamination between the groups. This was because it was left up to the treating physician to try non-invasive ventilation for the standard group or the high-flow oxygen group if the patient was looking worse.
Yeah, for example, 50% of the non-invasive group was on positive pressure ventilation for 8 hours or less each day, and the remainder of the time they were just wearing a standard oxygen face mask. Similarly, the high-flow oxygen group may have been put on non-invasive before attempting intubation, although they don't tell us how many actually were.
And this amount of crossover or contamination between these three groups could have impacted on the intention to treat analysis.
So our fourth concern was the power of the trial. This was a negative trial, but they powered the study to detect a 20% difference in intubation rate and failed to achieve this result. That does not mean that there is no difference or that the treatments are equivalent.
I think that's a good important point that you just made. This was a superiority trial, and we can only conclude that the treatments were not shown to have a 20% superiority to the control. The fifth thing and the final thing we wanted to bring up was the secondary outcome. They highlighted in the conclusion the significant difference in the mortality at 90 days. This study was not powered for mortality, but rather to demonstrate an absolute difference of 20% in intubation rates, assuming an intubation rate of 60%. And as we mentioned earlier, if you do go to clinicaltrials.gov, you see that their protocol says for the secondary outcome, it was for mechanical ventilation free to day 28 and ICU morbidity at 28 days, not mortality. The paper says mortality in the ICU, mortality at 90 days, the number of vent-free days between day 1 and 28, and the duration of ICU stay. So the paper's secondary outcome are different than the originally submitted protocol's secondary outcome. And this always makes me a little bit more skeptical. So let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
So we agreed that the three different oxygenation strategies did not result in significantly different intubation rates.
And we are less enthusiastic about the secondary endpoint that showed a decreased mortality with high-flow nasal oxygen, but think it is an interesting finding that should generate a hypothesis for future research. But here's the bottom line. High-flow nasal oxygen can be another tool in that toolbox to address patients in acute respiratory distress, but does not appear to be superior to standard care or non-invasive ventilation in this study. Can you give us a case resolution?
Yeah. So you try the high-flow nasal oxygen, but the patient continues to get clinically worse, so you switch over to non-invasive ventilation.
So here's how I'm going to clinically apply this. I'm comfortable using non-invasive ventilation and probably going to continue doing this given the good evidence to support this practice. However, for those patients not able to tolerate non-invasive ventilation, high-flow nasal oxygen would be a reasonable option to try.
So what do I tell my patient? I would say your current oxygen level is low and I think you require supplemental oxygen. We have three different types of oxygen mask: the usual one that you're wearing, a tight-fitting high-pressure mask, and a mask that only goes in your nose. The current evidence indicates they will probably all work for you, so you should tell us which seems the most comfortable.
If you want some more foamy goodness on this topic, The Bottom Line did a review, so did Palm CCM and EM Nerd by Rory Spiegel. Well, that brings us to the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Greg Rogers from Kentucky. That's a back-to-back win for Greg, so he will be receiving a double-strength, cool, skeptical prize. Greg was able to name five risk factors that were associated with spontaneous subarachnoid hemorrhage, and those included smoking, hypertension, AVM, polycystic kidney disease, and cocaine use. What's the question this week, Justin?
Well, speaking of oxygen, a recent study published in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine used oxygen in a very unusual way in an attempt to prevent acute mountain sickness. What did they do?
Ooh, Mountain sickness. Well, if you know the answer to this week's Keener contest question, then send me an email to thesgem@gmail.com and use Keener in that subject line. The first correct answer will win a cool skeptical prize. Well, thanks, Justin, for being our guest skeptic this week. Wish you could have been here with me in Boston.
I wish I was there as well.
Well, next year, Vegas.
Ooh, Vegas, baby.
And if you haven't checked out Justin's great blog, I suggest you do. It's first10em.com.
Thanks.
But Justin, before we go, can you give that SGEM tagline?
Absolutely. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.